Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week, we are heading to Highland Park to sit down with chef and partner of Highly Likely, Kat Turner. We chat about her time as a private chef. She shares an incredible story about doing laundry for the Smashing Pumpkins in Tokyo. And we talk about the community she has built in her two cafes in L.A., and then we keep up our Philadelphia heater run as we dip into the archive to chat with Mike McGinnis, who plays guitar in Rid of Me and runs Knife Hit Records. He chatted with us about the pandemic's influence on their latest EP, their future plans for shows, and what goes into selecting the perfect cover song. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes on HRN. Kat, welcome to Snacky Tunes. So happy for you to make the time and sit down with us. I feel Well, I'll just say I feel so happy that you opened up close to me in Highland Park because I've been using it as like a third space office. So thank you for that at the very top.
It was all for you, Darren.
Oh, thank you. Yes, of course. I saw the business plan and it makes total sense. Just how does it all affect me?
Exactly.
I'm glad we got to do this. I know you were just in New York and I always have to ask, where did you eat? What did you hit? Were there places that you go back to every time you go to the city that's just your standard bearer?
Oh, man. Well, the funny thing about this trip to New York is that I basically didn't go anywhere. It's like, it's honestly such a blur. I was there filming Chopped. And nice. They really like, they fly you in, they toss you in a hotel, you're filming. And then it's like, you know, right back to LA. I went to a spot in, my business partner, Alex, was coincidentally in New York at the same time. And we met at a like Mexican restaurant in Greenpoint that I just honestly can't remember the name of, but it was
those
good.
Those Toros or I'm trying to remember what's over there. That's when I was up there.
Hold on. I can tell you.
But it's in and out. I mean, the great thing about going to New York now is that so much stuff can also be delivered to a hotel room or to your house in a DoorDash Upmark at maybe lower quality than if you eat there. But you can get whatever you want.
Totally. Oxomoco.
Wow. New spot.
It was like
it's cool.
Yeah, splashy, modern Mexican. It was good. It was nice just to like come off of a long day of filming and like land in a restaurant and get some delicious tostadas and, you know, have a glass of something,
get a little bit of that legendary Williamsburg Greenpoint service, right?
Yeah, exactly. Top notch.
You know, it's so funny because when I moved from Williamsburg to Silver Lake, everyone's like, oh, Silver Lake is the Williamsburg of LA. But I feel like Highland Park has really taken over that role with like the walkability and the closeness and the stores and the restaurants and the vibe over there in the community.
Yeah, I think Highland Park is nipping, certainly like nipping at the ankles of, you know, Silver Lake. If you look at, you know, Sunset Junction and what they've done with Sunset over the years, I think that definitely feels kind of Williamsburg-y, and Highland Park has got, you know, a bit of that kind of Greenpoint neighborhoody, a little cozier. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's always so interesting when you start looking at New York and LA, especially like with restaurants, because I always felt that like New York was reliant on like the financial sector and so much like the business people were, you know, more of like a nightlife crowd. And I feel that LA has this relationship with like Hollywood and things like that. And I know that you were in the business before the restaurant business. Do you still feel that that relationship is still there? Like that Hollywood and the restaurant industry in LA really works hand in hand?
Definitely. Definitely. We see it in different ways. I know a lot of restaurants in Hollywood and the Valley got really smashed by the strike. Such a huge, you know, pool of people in the entertainment industry. I wouldn't say that we suffered too badly. West Adams and, you know, Highland Park, I think, are a little less dense for industry folks. But as far as people, you know, using it as a third space, as a working space, I mean, there's always somebody there writing a script. And, you know, at this point, it's like it could be like Greta Gerwig or J.J. Abrams. I'm like stunned at the people that walk in the door.
Oh, I mean, I was camped out there for a few hours and next to me was the most Hollywood development conversation. It felt I was like, where's the cameras? Like, is this really what people are talking about here? But it's just, I mean, it's a comfortable spot. You know, just
we get less
nice
of
to get
that.
Every house. Yeah.
We get less of that in West Adams.
Oh, yeah. No, Highland Park is like,
yeah. Yeah. It's a little different in Highland Park.
you know, I know that you used to be more in the Hollywood scene and now you're obviously in the food scene. What drew you from, you know, in front of the camera to like back of house in the kitchen being a chef?
Yeah. Well, in 2008, we had a big writer strike and a big financial crisis and with the housing market, everything. And at that time, I was working as an actress. I was a burlesque performer. I was working as a shop girl at Agent Provocateur. I was hustling around doing a bunch of different things. But I also started working at my friend's restaurant in Silver Lake, a little vegan spot called Flore. That just closed recently.
Yeah.
Had a hell of a run. And and I started cooking there part-time and I realized that I loved cooking. And at that point I was already 29 and I thought, well, I don't want to be a line cook and I don't want to have my own restaurant, but I think I'd be a great private chef, you know, because I knew already so many people in the, you know, entertainment, music industry. Yeah. I was like, oh, this could be a good transition for me. And so I went to culinary school in New York in 2008. And when I got done with that, I moved back to LA. I worked at Blue Hill for a little bit for free for 4 months.
Yeah, back. Those times have sort of changed, right? Yeah, yeah.
Back when it was an honor to do that kind of work and not get paid for it. And I came back and I started working as a private chef for Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins, and went on tour and did that for a couple of years. And it was awesome. And that kind of launched my career as a private chef.
What story can you share from the road with that? With obviously not getting yourself in trouble and who knows how long those NDAs actually last.
Well, totally. Well, one of my favorite memories was when they toured in Japan and I was begging Billy to take me with him because I had never been to Japan, never been to Tokyo. And he said, you know, we don't really have it in the budget to bring a chef and I don't really need to bring a chef to Japan. He said, but if you can also help us do wardrobe, because I was also a wardrobe stylist in the past. And he said, if you can help us with the wardrobe, we'll bring you with. You know, we'll pay for the flight and we'll pay for the hotel, but we can't pay you to be there, but you can come along. And I was like thrilled at this. I was like, oh my God, I might never get the chance to go to Japan again. And here being flown there and being put up in a beautiful hotel. So we go. And, that first morning, I got saddled with these two giant bags of laundry from the show from the night before.
Stop.
And I had to go find a laundromat in Tokyo and we were staying at the Conrad Hotel and I got into a taxi cab. The front desk had given me the address for like a coin laundry and I was able to exchange some yen and get some coins. And this taxi driver drops me off at this coin laundry place in a neighborhood where there's just like normal people doing their laundry.
Yeah.
These two big like laundry bags. I'm like, whatever, this is what you do. You figure it out. And so I had to have somebody help me, but I figured it out and got the laundry going. And to kill time, I just went to go walk around the neighborhood. And what I didn't realize is that he had dropped me off at a laundromat right next to the Tsukiji fish market. Yeah. And so it's like 7 a.m. and it's the middle of summer. And it's hot. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm literally here. And walked into the fish market and saw just a spot that had a line and got in line and sat down at this bar and had an ice cold Sapporo and the best sushi of my life. And I just remember just like a tear rolling down my face, just the level of gratitude and that feeling of, you know, when you have something that's so good and you're like, well, clearly I've never had sushi before in my life.
Yeah. Because when you're like, you know, that's so incredible because it wasn't like you did a ton of research. I mean, you probably knew where you were going, but to just like randomly look up, I feel like that those experiences are so few and far between now, because everyone, when they travel, it's like, I'm going here, this is all planned out and things like this. And here you think you're getting saddled with like hours of laundry, yeah, and you're having a meal that people travel the world for just dropped in your lap.
Completely. Yeah. And then just having the leisurely stroll through the market and the ability to
kind of, I mean, it's one of all time.
Yeah. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I'd love to know what the band was eating at the time. They probably, if it was a lesser meal than fresh sushi at one of the world's most famous fish markets.
They were getting hotel eggs, I'm sure, delivered to the room. Which has its own perks, you know?
I'm not laughing at it. I'm just saying it's just, yeah. 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 Oh my God. That's so incredible.
It's incredible. And the funny thing is that I remember that intense desire to go, and that, you know, it felt so, oh my God, like I'll never get to do this again. I'll never get to do this again. This is so cool. And then going on to work for, you know, other people as a private chef. And I was in Japan twice a year for like years and spent actually an incredible amount of time being able to explore Tokyo Tokyo and Osaka, Okinawa. And kind of, but always reflecting on that first time of like, wow, I thought I'd never be back here again. And
I'm sure it's never, I'm sure you haven't hit the point where you're like, Tokyo again, eye roll, right? God,
take me now. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the biggest piece of advice when I went there for the first and only time was you'll be back, because it's so dense and there's so many layers, and even more so than any city like New York or LA or Mexico City that's like spread out, the density of Tokyo is it's unknowable in so many ways.
Oh, yeah. It's like an incredible udon shop, and then five stories up this, you know, little skinny building is this unbelievable like bespoke cocktail bar, or this like Japanese record bar, or like
the best pour over you've ever had.
Yeah, exactly. Like the most insane coffee, or the best French restaurant you've ever eaten at. Like, so crazy.
All right. I want to take a quick musical break. And then we come back. I want to talk about the opening of Highly Likely, the incredible music that you play at the restaurants, and more of the community you've built in LA. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Back in the moonlit fields, living together.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Kat Turner, chef and partner at Highly Likely. So obviously you're in this enticing world of private chefdom that, I mean, I don't know the hours, but you know, it's a decent work-life balance at times. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of hours, but it's different. It's a different investment in who you are as a person than owning a restaurant. But you had said in the first act, you didn't even want to have one. What changed for you? What flipped that switch and saying like, maybe I want to open up a spot. Maybe I don't want to just cook for one private person at a time.
Yeah. I had made the transition from this kind of myopic world of cooking for one person. In 2015, I started working with Summit Series. They do these large scale kind of amazing conferences. And I went on a cruise ship with them, Summit at Sea. And it was a real wild ride. Went from learning how to cook for, you know, a small handful of people to 3,000 people. And from there, I went up to Utah, where they had a mountain called Powder Mountain. I was living up there for the season. And my business partner, my now business partner, Carrie Mosier, whose family started Cafe Gratitude and Gracias Madre, he was there attending one of the kind of smaller mountain conferences. And I met with him and he said, "Hey, do you want to open a restaurant in LA?" And I said, no, not really. And he said, "Why?" I said, I don't really know how to do it. You know, I don't have a ton of restaurant experience. And he just said, "Look, if you can cook for hundreds of people on top of a mountain in a remote part of Utah, you can figure out
how to run a
restaurant. Yeah, and make it taste good. If you can make eggs like this for hundreds of people on a mountaintop." And he just said, "You know, I've done this for the better part of my life, and everything I know, I'll teach you." He said, "But I believe that, he said, "I believe that you're the right fit for us." And he said, "My Scorpio rising is telling me that you're the right fit for us." And I came back to LA and I saw the space and I love West Adams, and it's conveniently close to my house. I live in Koreatown. So I took a risk, and I also kind of had this realization that who's ever going to offer me this again? You know, it's kind of like Japan all over again. Like, who's ever going to offer me this again? I need to take it. I need to figure it out. Like, what's the worst thing that happens? You know, it's like,
So it's do laundry, wind up at the best fish market in the world, go cook on a mountain, get offered the insider track to opening a restaurant in LA. All right. So let me just, I'm just writing a business plan for myself now.
Notes.
Yeah. So, you know, you have a really great concept, you know, the morning to afternoon, and now you've extended to night in Highland Park, but where did you land on this approach to cooking and food? And, you know, it felt pretty dialed in or a clear point of view from the very beginning for a spot that was open for so many hours.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, it's funny. I don't really have anything to compare it to since I never had a restaurant before this.
Sure.
It was definitely, you know, it's a group effort. I have incredible business partners. We work really hard together to bring a collective vision to the table. Everybody wanted an all day spot. And, you know, there are a lot of conversations around what does that feel like? What does that mean? What is the, you know, service model? Who works there? You know, like, can people be on their laptops? Like, what time do we stop having people on their laptops? So it's just this kind of constant evolving conversation around service and building community and hospitality. And for me, from the culinary standpoint, I mean, I say this like 100 times a day, it feels like, but like, I'm from Wisconsin. One thing that, like, you'll hear me say that over and over and over again. I'm from Wisconsin. At the core, like comfort is at my core, mm-hmm. you know, and making people feel good and not alienating anyone with a menu and giving people a restaurant that they can come to, you know, for breakfast and then come back for dinner. And, you know, maybe it's a spot where they come for happy hour with their girlfriends and then Friday night they're on a date or they're bringing their kids to brunch. I didn't have a ton of restaurants that we went to growing up. I grew up in such a small town, but we did have a, you know, two or three spots that we went to and those were our spots. And we still go to those spots. I mean, this is like, you know, 40 plus years of my life of going to the same restaurants. And that's the kind of brand that I want to build. I want to build a brand that, like, you know, transcends generations.
That I mean, feels you talk like about that. Yeah. And you do talk about that as a big inspiration of having a steady stream of regulars, which I have found as the restaurants that I've seen that have gone on or live longer than a life of a media cycle is the only way to really survive. But it's interesting as a business model. So how do you marry that idea of catering to regulars while also making it a business?
So how do I cater to regulars, but also make it a business?
Yeah. Only because, you know, it's like, you got to think about price points. You got to think about people returning. You got to think about, like, you know, enticing people to want to come back maybe 2-3 times a week or make it their spot every week. How do you figure that in, especially as like cost rises and neighborhoods change and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, we have, I'd say we have a pretty moderately priced menu, mm-hmm. which still kind of feels insane to me. Prices are the things that have happened to food costs in the last few years and labor and everything.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Again, coming from somewhere like Wisconsin, looking at our menu and feeling like it's moderately priced for LA it's interesting. But you know, having an affordable menu, having regulars, I mean, regulars are our business, mm-hmm. Generating that return, those people that come back every single day. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're getting a lot of unique visits, but we're getting tons of return visits. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think becoming a benchmark of a community is, you know, is the best thing that we've been able to do. I mean, West Adams, it's packed every day and it's the same people for the last 5 years. They just keep coming back.
I mean, it's interesting because West Adams was open pre-pandemic and then Highland Park opened post-pandemic. And obviously it's an interesting thing because it's sometimes people have opened new restaurants, completely new concepts, but you opened similar concepts, same concepts, but in different parts of the city. What did you take from, let's say, pre-2020 that was working? And like, what did you adapt when you reopened and with the new spot to allow both to thrive?
Man, yeah. I mean, pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, we were pretty lucky. We didn't have to change a whole lot. I mean, we were set up with outdoor seating. We were set up with to go, you know, we kind of like rode the wave of all of it. I think the biggest thing to come out of that time was that we were able to grow our wine program. That was really huge for us. So West Adams, you know, not only is it, you know, a really great kind of all day dining spot, we have an incredible bottle shop that our beverage manager, Jose, has like curated really, really beautifully. And that was something that grew out of that. And the ability to, like, knowing that we really want to have patio, that's like a huge part of our brand as well. Like when we look at new places, new spaces around, you know, around the city, it's like, okay, where's the patio, you know?
Yeah. And the Highland Park one's a great patio.
Great patio. I mean, that was a parking lot. It's insane. No. When I look at the before.
Really?
Yeah, that was a parking lot. That was a parking lot. we have incredible landscape designer back there.
Can't even tell. You know, speaking of curation, most of the times when I'm working out of a coffee shop or restaurant, headphones are in from the moment I walk in the door. I take them out when I order because I don't want to be rude. And then they just go right back on until I leave. I don't think I've ever reached for them working out of your restaurant. And that's because the soundtracks have been incredible. So
thank you.
Who does the music? How do you pick it? Obviously, and I've had dinner there, so I know there's like a different vibe day to night. But what goes into it, and how do you pick the right songs to match the vibe?
Yeah, this is so funny. I was just having a long conversation about that because we're in the middle of kind of building, vibes like daytime, what's mm-hmm. the morning, what's the, midday, what's the night vibe, and just making sure that everybody is on the same page as far as like keeping things consistent. I love music. I listen to, all kinds of different stuff all day long. And the thing I always tell the team is like, no matter what time of day it is, make it smart, make it smart. Make the music, if it's, it could be, something light and jazzy. It could be something kind of standard, like a Bill Charlap trio or, Astrid Gilberto, but like no Fallout Boy. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, and not, just like, and that's like, there's, not to say that like Fallout Boy isn't smart, but like, it doesn't like lift me up. It doesn't make me feel like smarter when I listen to it. And I want music to make me feel smarter. I want it to make me feel sexier. I want it to make me curious. I want it to also kind of like bleed into the background. And every now and then you catch something that you really love and you're like, well, what was that? You grab your Shazam. It should never encroach on, on your personal experience, but it should like uplift you. And at night, it's always got to be like, it's always got to be sexy. It's always got to be fun, mm-hmm. like even like morning jazzy stuff. Like I don't want like sad boy, sad girl music, I always want it to have a little bit of fun to it. A little bit of, fun vibe, sexy, smart. So yeah. I mean, there's artists that I go to all the time. I love, disco. I'm a huge disco fan. Disco at Dinner is amazing. Italian disco, like, bands like Jungle or Parcels mm-hmm. or, fun stuff like that is really great. Lunchtime stuff like Sudan Archives or, Fela Kuti is always, anytime I can't think of like what I want to listen to, it's like, put on Fela Kuti radio.
Yeah. Just put it on. Just throw it on. I mean, it's a good vibe and it's always, I like the idea. I've never heard of a playlist being described as make it smart. But that's such a great center to work from. Because, like, look, you can play punk. Just be smart in your choice of what it's going to be and the song it's going to be. The last time I was in there for dinner was January. I was doing Dry January. And what I loved about what was – the night was that the music was going, it felt really sexy and cool. And then the thought you had put into, like the non-alcoholic listings and like offering different food and cuisine for people who were on their own journey and things like that. And that's not easy because you have X amount of room in the bar, X amount of room in the kitchen. But we all know that like a lot of people are going through changes in the food community and things like that with the way that they want to eat and drink. So how do you find that balance to put up the menu you want to put up with, but then also know like the communities that you have in West Adams and then also Highland Park and knowing that like there's been a shifting mindset in the type of offerings that people want when they go to restaurants like yours?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't speak too much to the drinks. I mean, I do have some input on our bar menu, but we've got some really incredible people that have contributed to that. And, there is such a, Dry January aside, there are so many people that are, either refraining from alcohol or, want to go out and just not drink that night. And, mm-hmm. Having something that's just not like a bitters and soda for them is a fun opportunity. And as far as the menu goes, I think being a private chef for so long kind of helped with the ability to navigate what other people want versus what I want to make. And so when I am creating dishes, a lot of it is, I mean, there are dishes on the menu that I personally don't like. They're just things that I wouldn't necessarily order, but I know that there's somebody out there that is really going to love it.
Right.
You know? And so I do cook for the community as much as I cook for myself.
Huh. That's interesting. You may be the first person to ever been on the show who admitted they have stuff on their menu that they don't like, but it's for the people.
I'm not a kale salad girl, but people love my kale salad. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of thing.
That kale salad's phenomenal.
You got to have a kale salad on the menu though, right?
I'm sorry. You can't be in LA in this time. I mean, you could go over Dikio now. I've seen that replacing a couple of kale Caesars, but you know,
that's
few and far between. So
I love a chicory.
Oh yeah. So you have the two spots. You're doing a lot of consulting work. Are you looking at other places that can have patios? What's the future look like for you? Or do you feel like you have two kids that you can look after very well?
Oh no. My mom had six kids. So.
Oh, there you go.
I don't have human children, but I could very easily have six restaurants. So I think, stay tuned on that one. We are definitely expansion is part of our plan.
I mean, I know Highland Park is close, but if you want to come to Altadena, we will not say no.
Mom's the word on that one.
Mom's
but,
the
you
word.
Know, I mean, we look, I love, you know, I you know, I know the guys from John and Vinny's and, you know, I think they've done a good job of, you know, expanding their brand or, you know, places like Home State or, you know, Kismet Rotisserie you know, there are people that, you know, you see them popping up and you're like, oh, that's smart. The next spot to go look at.
Yeah. It's like, okay, let me just look. Okay. Brentwood, Playa Vista. Okay. I'm just following the map around the city.
Yeah.
Well, Kat, I can't thank you enough for making the time. If people want to stop by or see what's going on, where can they go? How can they get involved with what you're up to?
Yeah. Well, you can follow us on Instagram at It's Highly Likely. And we are in Highland Park on Figueroa, and we are in West Adams on Jefferson.
Amazing.
And maybe, you know, soon to be coming to your neighborhood.
Oh man. I've been saying forever.
That's a collective yard. That could be, it could be Mar Vista. It could be the Valley. It could be Altadena. Like we'll see where we land.
Well, I thought we already established that you're open restaurants based on my needs and my needs alone. So it's just got to be within walking distance to my house, right?
I'll put you in touch with our lawyer.
Yeah, I'll show
some
spots.
We can pencil the contract.
Well, Kat, so great to catch up with you. Congrats on everything. Looking forward to coming out and working out of the restaurant very soon. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Thank you. Mike, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us. We always appreciate another Philly boy being on this show. A little taste of home.
Yeah, man. Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, man. My pleasure. Let's just sort of give a little context for people who might not be as familiar with the Philly music scene. Let's go, I don't know. Let's go late 2019, early 2020. Where was the Philly music scene? What was going on? What was where was your place in it, both as a record label owner and in a band?
Well, so the label was semi, I wouldn't say dormant. I was playing in a band that we had just started, I guess maybe the year prior, called Low Dose. And I kind of resurrected the label to self-release some of the formats for that record. I was most of my involvement was, I was a bartender at Kung Fu Necktie for about 8 years. Mm. So that was, you know, that was a big thing. I was also playing in a band called Plaque Marks, which I don't play in anymore. So I was active in a lot of ways. Fight Amp was my most active band before that, but we broke up in 2016. So.
Got it. And the Philly scene as a whole, the community, I mean, it's always been a tight-knit community. It's a much – I know Philly seems big, but it really is a small town.
When you're here, it feels like a small town, that's for sure. But some – I would say there's a few different scenes that sort of get fractured just by the geography of the city.
Sure.
South, north, and west, you know.
So pandemic hits and I know that the record label was dormant and you were in Low Dose, but things changed a bit for you with both the band you're in and sort of a reconfiguring of the record label. Talk us through what happened.
Well, right before the pandemic hit, Low Dose sort of naturally was going to take a little hiatus for an undetermined amount of time. A couple of the members just had to focus on life and work and other projects. And Iteria and I wanted to stay active, so we just decided to start another band. And this was, I mean, literally maybe December of 2019 or something like that. We rapidly wrote 4 songs. Hmm. Recruited our old friend Mike Howard, who was the second drummer of Fight Amp and played in bands like Ladder Devils and stuff like that. And we got it together and quickly recorded it in the beginning of February of 2020. And then I went on a tour with another band for almost a month and got back right in the beginning of March.
Wow.
And that's like, yeah, and that's right when I remember sitting at a bar and seeing that the NBA season was canceled. And this new band, Rid of Me, had a tour scheduled in May with Soul Glow. It was like 3 or 4 weeks or something. And I remember my last bartending shift was Friday, March 13th. And that's when everything just got shut down. And we were just sitting back wondering if it was just going to be one of those, is this going to be 2-3 weeks or 2-3 months? And, you know, and then everything just started getting canceled. And that's when we wanted to be an active band. So we had to, you know, reinvent what we were going to do instead of playing shows. So that was write music and release tapes. And we brought Ruben from Soul Glow into the band, which probably wouldn't have happened otherwise. So,
yeah, I mean, it's tough to say positive pandemic experience, right? I think it's
right. Yeah.
No one wants to glorify it, but if you're a creative person as you are, and you have a life on the road or your life out and about, being at home, I don't know if it's force or allows you, whichever route you want to take, to maybe create and work with people that you wouldn't have had a chance to do so. So do you look back on at least that first year or the first – before the first reopening, and who knows what's happening now, but as a positive time or a tough time where you were able to create some art, how did you approach it?
I mean, it's all of the above. I mean, because it was like day to day, and I knew I couldn't just sit here and watch TV and drink. You know what I mean? I mean, I could,
sure,
but I would lead to some, ultra negativity. So And not that I didn't do those things. There was a lot of time to kill. But I just, and my bandmates, you know, we had to find ways to move forward, not lose our minds, be creative, and use the time that we had to our advantage. And it was the same with the label. I had it sitting there and I was using it for my own bands. And so, yeah, I had this time, and why not put some of it into another musical endeavor that, you know, branched out beyond my bands. So
I love it.
It was positive and it was negative.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause there were rough days, obviously.
I mean, it's a year. Even in the best of times, there are rough days in a year.
For sure. All right, yeah, and it's still a bumpy road. So
yeah, it's still a bumpy road. I think, well, I don't know what to think because I don't know what's happening. You know, recording on what, the 28th of July, and the CDC just said masks back on. So it's just like, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep, I know.
Well, how about this? Let's hear a song appropriately maybe titled I Don't Wanna. What's the story behind it, and when did you lay this one down?
So this was originally recorded for our, we call it our EP. It was a sort of a rushed demo session for our first recording. It's also going to appear more definitively on our LP, which comes out this fall. So we recorded this and the other two live songs for you guys, just locally, like in our neighborhood here in Port Richmond. So this is a live version of that song that's going to be on two of our releases.
Awesome. Well, we have I Don't Wanna by Red and Me here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.org.
Yeah.
Welcome back, Snacky Tunes. That was just I Don't Wanna Live, Rid of Me. We have Mike McGinnis, guitar player in the band. And, you know, creating anything during a time like a pandemic, I would say probably tough to not have some of those themes or feelings wind up in the music that you're recording. I know that the last EP has a cover in it, but also has an original, and you're also writing other music. Did you put any of the experiences and feelings from the pandemic into the new music that you've been writing?
Yeah, it was impossible not to. Right. I mean, even the way we were, a lot of it was like file trades, because even we were just staying home alone for a little while in the first couple months there before we started actually getting in a room together again. So, yeah, it just, you know, the canvas sort of helped make the painting for sure.
Hmm. Any songs that, or maybe not even songs, but were there any moments where you went, I would have never done this pre-pandemic, I would have never written this type of song or this type of lyric, but now you're like, it, you know, I have the freedom to, or the desire to put this type of sentiment, you know, recorded for the, you know, all ages of time.
Yeah, I think because a lot of what we did while we were writing the LP, and then as we started to record the LP, we were, because we couldn't play shows, we were releasing these like little cassette, like, you know, the most recent one with the Sheryl Crow cover is a 2-song cassette that I'm releasing on my label. Mm. And a lot of them are self-recorded. The B-side on that is like, I do the vocals on it, which I'm not the vocalist in this band, but we just sort of, yeah, we put out some songs that we maybe would have remained demos otherwise, you know? So yeah, we definitely had a little bit more output than we would have. And there's a few songs in there that went that way. And we were able to explore, I think some of the dynamics were, you know, we explored a little more than we would have.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's talk about that Sheryl Crow cover. it's a banger. And I know that you've also talked about, you have a Beastie Boys cover coming out. How do you pick your covers? And what makes you want to do a cover? Because it's sort of that balance of you want to be – I've heard ones that have gone completely off the rails, and I'm like, I don't love this as a cover. It's just a different song. So you want it to be both familiar and new. You know, how did you pick Sheryl Crow, and what's your approach to these types of recordings?
I think Itaria wanted to cover that even before this band started. And again, it was sort of that time we had during the pandemic. And like, hey, let's amass some stuff for these like cassette releases that we wouldn't normally do. Mm. The Sheryl Crow cover, I think, is like, that's one of those songs where if you listen to the original, the way it's like presented aesthetically might make you not like it, because it has that country twang and some people don't appreciate that, but it's still a really well-written and performed song.
It's a ripper.
So we kind of took that, you know, we slowed it down-tuned it a little and turned it not into a country song. And then a lot of the feedback has been, wow, I didn't realize that was such a well-written song. You know, it's because the, you know, the aesthetic choices definitely can influence people's opinion on it. That's how that one came about. We're about to do a whole bunch. Once we did those two, they were just so much fun. And we just decided we're just going to do more. And we're not being too picky about it. If anyone wants to do anything, we just say, hey, sure, it's on the table. And as long as our drummer can learn it and go record drums, we can self-record everything else. So he's going to record, like, he has a list of 40 right now.
Wow.
that he's learning, and he's going to go track them on his own to click tracks. And we're just going to cherry pick some and just leak them out little by little on some different releases.
You know, having a good cover back catalog makes for a great Halloween and or New Year's type of set.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that it's going to be a blessing and a curse, because we're not always practicing these covers, because not a cover band. Not we're not a cover band, sure. But we're venturing on the territory of becoming half a cover band. So I know when once we start playing shows, there's going to be that, hey, play blah, blah, blah. And we're going to go, we don't know it right now.
We don't know it. We don't know it right now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear an original. Next song is Broke Shit. What's the story behind this one?
Actually, our drummer wrote the bass and drums to it. This was one of those early ones. I think we had written it right before Ruben joined the band, and then Ruben and I kind of like sprinkled the guitars on top. Itaria's lyrics, I can't speak for her, but I know they're pretty politically driven. Some lefty shit.
Awesome. All right. Well, here we go. Broke Shit, Rid of Me, live on Snacky Tunes on HRN.org. That was just Broke Shit, Rid of Me. Mike, I want to shift to the label a little bit, which we had talked about at the top of our conversation. What made you ultimately want to get this thing going again, especially since it was dormant pre-pandemic?
It's something that was never like completely dormant. I would resurrect it throughout the years since the beginning of my old band Fight Amp. I would resurrect it like intermittently to kind of like serve whatever purpose I needed it to serve.
Sure.
And then having the time during the pandemic to kind of look at it and take a step back just made me realize it was something that I could do. Especially with just getting like doing mostly cassettes. I'm not strictly a cassette label, but I make sure there's always like a, because I have like you know, I'll digitally just distribute records as well. Mm-hmm. But I always want there to be like a physical artifact, and a cassette is a very like affordable, quick turnaround time way to do that. And if you're not into the cassette, you can always just listen to it on Spotify or whatever. So I guess that, and just, it was just like another creative project. I was sort of maxing myself out on my own band and a side project band. And I didn't want to like start a third band. So I wanted something involved with music that, you know, was outside of my own, you know, hearing riffs in my head and recording them and stuff.
Mm. I mean, it's also nice to not always be like, listen to my music, listen to my thing. It's nice to be supportive of the scene in the community.
Yeah. And that was like my way of doing that. It's, again, it's very limited capacity, like of what I can do. And it's like, it slowly is growing. But yes, I can like take my friends' bands and hopefully soon people that I'm not even directly friends with and release stuff and have it be my way of contributing, you know?
Did you find it to be a good or different way to connect with people during the last year and change, especially as everyone was sort of isolated at home?
Yeah. And I guess I didn't really think about that at the time, but in retrospect, it was like a really nice way to be able to connect with people. You know, that didn't feel forced or anything.
Now, some of our older listeners might be hearing the word cassette and going, I don't understand. I thought those died out. But obviously anyone who's been following certain scenes know that cassettes have not only been back for a while, but are really in fashion, especially as limited editions and things like that. What do you love about the format, and how does one even go about getting a cassette made these days?
Well, so the number one thing, and you know, cassettes have these like detractors that just never, like I recently listened to a podcast on another podcast that I recently did called The Northeast Scene, and they had Matt from the Get Up Kids, and I was the previous guest, and they brought up cassettes on that, and he was just like, oh, what is the point? Don't even bother. And I get that notion, but my rebuttal to that is always the cassette is in a world of digital streaming, and like a lot of releases don't even come out on any physical format often. Mm. So if you can make a physical artifact and it's affordable to make and affordable to sell, and it's not backed up in this insane world of like where vinyl is right now, where the wait times are a year and Amazon's flooding the market and all these things, it's very like for the common person. Mm. Like you can still make them for cheap, at least relatively, and sell them for cheap relatively, as vinyl prices are skyrocketing. Now, I'm saying this, and knock on wood, this could change. My manufacturer just told me prices are going up. So because there's a worldwide cassette shells shortage right now.
Sure.
Go figure.
I have to imagine that there's one depot of cassette shells, and it's just slowly dwindling as more and more indie bands and punk rockers put out cassettes. But it's great to have something physical. It's so interesting to see how vinyl has now swung back into be such a demand.
I know. It just surpassed CDs, I think, for the first time ever, which I'm surprised it actually took that long.
But, yeah, I mean, who's buying a CD these days?
Yeah, I know.
Poor CDs.
Well, that might change too. So.
Right. Yeah. It's like, oh, we can't make records and we can't make tapes. We're going back to CDs. But I mean, CDs just never have had or will the same aesthetic as a cassette tape or an LP.
No, I think what's keeping them in demand are the fact that there's still enough people driving cars from the 90s and 2000s that can load a CD into that CD player.
I mean, honestly, up until 2 years ago, I had a tape player, had all my high school tapes, just ripping them, all the new tapes and everything. It was great. Now I'm tape deckless, but you know, that's what eBay's for.
Yeah. Somebody's got to start manufacturing those again. I think they do, but it's kind of like a boutique.
Oh yeah. It's like, oh cool. A $2,500 tape player. Cool.
Yeah. I see him on Sweetwater, and you know, I don't want to click on anything because I know they'll start texting.
Hey,
me
man,
day.
Just want to make sure you get everything you need. It's like, yeah, bud. Thanks, Phil from Sweetwater. So as we head, you know, into the fall, out of the summer, things like that. And we're sort of in this, you know, tours are starting again, bands are playing again, but who knows what's going to happen. Rid of Me, you going on the road, you playing local shows. What's the Philly scene looking like as far as live music?
Yeah, we have nothing is announced yet, but I think we have something like 7 shows booked right nice. Now that are all, I think our first local show is going to be announced, I think tomorrow. Mm. So that'll be up.
That'll be up by the time this airs.
This comes out. Yeah. And then I believe that's still going to be limited capacity because it's in August. Mm. And then I'm pretty sure. And well, if that's up by the time this airs, it's August 20th at Ortlieb's.
Ooh, shout out Ortlieb's.
Yeah. Love it. And we have, so our record's going to come out in, I believe the release date is set for late November. So I think we have like a mini like regional thing from DC to Boston, like 4 shows booked. That's going to be our like mini record release run. We have some random shows, some DIY shows like in Richmond, Virginia and stuff like that. But they're all, there's like this hesitancy happening right now. So I'm like being told like, hey, like everything's together, but we're going to kind of wait and see how these case numbers are looking. And that's what I'm hearing at the moment. So I guess it's just a wait and see.
Again. I hate it.
I know, especially after what we all just went through.
The only benefit would probably be my bank account to get refunds for all the tickets I bought for the fall and winter. But outside of that,
I'm
not looking forward to shows getting canceled again.
Yeah, I don't know. I just hope people do what they got to do to turn it around.
Yeah, I mean, look, if it takes people to, you know, be like, I can't go see this band if I don't get the vaccination shot to get a shot, I will, you know.
Yeah, I just please get vaccinated please. So we don't have to go through what we just went through again.
We don't have to. We wouldn't have to. Yep. Anyway, all right, time for one last song. We have Dealing. What's the story behind this one?
This was one of the I think it's the last one that came together while we were writing our LP. So this, again, another live version of this song. And thus far, this song is unreleased and will be on our LP that comes out in, I think, November. And I know Itaria's lyrics. This is, as far as I can tell, one that is definitely very influenced by being isolated during the pandemic.
Mm. Well, maybe it gives people some hope. But listen, Mike, thank you so much for the time. If people want to check out Rid of Me or get some cassettes from Knife Hit Records, where can they go?
Just knifehitsrecords.com.
Beautiful. All right. Well, thank you so much. Hopefully things line up when we're back in Philly for the holidays. Maybe we can even catch you guys playing live. And
that'd be awesome.
Want to also thank our food guests. We have another new episode next week. But first, we have Dealings here live on Snacky Tunes on hrn.org. We'll see you next time. Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.